about this, but I think that would be what would determine whether Europe lights up or not.
Yeah, well, Macron's not climbing without a net. He's got a safety cordon, a blue safety cordon. I'm watching coverage from Twitter on the streets from France and various cities. The police are especially brutal. Those guys with the blue stripe on their helmet, I've forgotten the name of them, but they're sort of the shock troops of their riot squads are particularly bad. And we saw the last time during the Gilets Jaunes, the people having their eyes shot out and so forth. And yet the French, God bless them, are coming out. And it's not all these black clad types. I mean, I'm sure that they're there as well. And there is violence and damage and fires and barricades and such. But it seems like a pretty rank and file citizenry from looking at the video that I've seen. And not only are they in the streets, but I guess for the older folks like me, where it might be too dangerous, I'm seeing huge manifestations in shopping malls and in stores and stuff where people are going in there with their casseroles and raising and whistles and just raising hell.
Yeah, I mean, we also have like a tradition of this kind of disruption, you know, as using the language that the state would use, right? Well, I think some activists would be comfortable with that too. But I mean, I think there's a tradition of that. And in a way, I think of this this event as one more symptom within a very sort of escalating battle between the people, if you like, and the elites, right? At least that's how it's articulated. And I see it as a continuity of the Gilets Jaunes, to be honest. Again, I see it as a continuity in the sense that the issues that were being addressed by the Gilets Jaunes are still the underlying issues here, right? In this case, it's materialized with this concrete tension, but it really is about how wealth is being distributed and redistributed in the Western world and in this particular European country, right? So while Macron is putting out the pension reform, he's also incrementing exponentially the military expenditure of France, right? And this is all to do with the war in Ukraine. At least this recent escalation in investment in military is obviously a direct consequence of the Ukrainian war, which is why I was suggesting before that what might happen in Europe will be, I think, at this stage determined by the economic situation, which if the war in Ukraine continues, will most likely become worse and worse.
And that's what I was referring to when I was saying, well, is the fire being lit in France going to spread to the rest of Europe? It seems like there's a split, and France has always been more individualistic when it comes to the European Union than most countries there. They've wanted to keep their own. They came in and out of NATO. They want to keep their autonomy. They jealously guard it. Even Macron, on his Chinese visit last week, ruffled feathers within the Union and confusion, I think, all around. I talked to Diana Johnstone, who lives in Paris, an American expat journalist who's lived there for 30 or more years now, about what's going on in France. And what she was talking about as far as the militarization of France and the war, she says in France, the Ukraine war against Russia is not even on the radar for almost anybody there. All they're talking about is this pension reform bill, which she says is much more complicated than just the age rise, where she says like less than a third of people over 60 are working or in the workforce anyway. But there's, according to her, that economically, the economic costs of the war haven't even registered yet. And so we're seeing if those ever register in France. I can't imagine, because we're already seeing tens of thousands in the street, and they're not, you know, just putting flowers in the barrels of the police riot guns or anything.
Yeah, it's interesting, this comment about war not being in the radar. I completely agree with you. In the mainstream conversation, the war is not in the radar. And that, I think, has to do predominantly with the way the framing, which has been very sophisticated and very, well, I don't know if sophisticated is the word, but it's been very effective of how to frame this war. So it almost became a war that you cannot censor, right? Because it's a war against the evil. The evil Putin, who is evil, you know, but also it's not just a war in Ukraine by Ukraine with Russia. I mean, the latest leaks are revealing that there has been elite forces from numerous European and the United States. So numerous European countries and the United States have been operating in Ukraine. Which means that, you know, and we also saw the Seymour Hersh, expose on the pipeline, and it's clear that this is not a war between the Ukraine and Russia. It's a war between the West and Russia, and most likely soon to come China in some form or another. I think there is an economic war going on, and there's definitely a lot of military maneuvering happening around China, and I guess my point is I don't really know how much all these wars are going to escalate, but if they do escalate, I mean, clearly one of the populations that's suffering the most of the cost of war, apart from those actually having the war in themselves, is the European citizenry. And the European citizenry at the same time, it's realizing that prices are going high. But it's not really connecting directly with the war effort. Or if it is, it's in a kind of, it's the war is might be a cause of this, but this is a war that is a necessary war, and therefore we have to put up with it. But I think that kind of imaginary is going to wear thin as time passes, and more families across Europe find themselves unable to cover the cost of living of their societies, which are increasingly becoming more and more expensive and less friendly to the working class.
Well, I wonder too. I remember a figure, and I'm not sure if it's current. This is some years ago that France's electricity is generated. Like 80% of France's electricity was generated from nuclear, so they wouldn't be affected by gas as much as, say, Germany, which I'm not sure what their numbers are, but it's certainly a lot less, especially in recent years, of nuclear power generation. And being confused about France, I think might be just the normal position. When Macron went to China, and he's a part of this big bloc that's obviously antagonistic towards China and growing more so every day. But he went to China and he said, and I'll quote him, he said, "We don't want to get into a bloc versus bloc kind of logic, being Europe. Europe shouldn't be caught up in a disordering of the world and crises that aren't ours." And this is what he said to the Chinese. Von der Leyen and the Germans were tap dancing to try to reassure the EU that everybody was on the same page, when it seems Macron, I don't know, he was maybe just going off script or something. He referred to, well, we don't want to follow American policy, as a panic reflex. And we want to avoid becoming a vassal state of America. These are pretty bold statements for the French president.
Yes, I mean, and I think we're going to hear, it is very bold, and especially coming from France, but I think we're going to hear more kind of dissenting views as time progresses from different countries. And I think the one that surprises me the most is the German case, and the lack of like any critique from its government, right, towards this situation. Because I mean, if you think, and this is, I'm going to go back to Seymour Hersh, because I think he says something very important. I mean, some people will treat him as a clown, but the truth is, I mean, I think his historical accuracy has proven quite remarkable. So I'm just going to go with the assumption that when he actually revealed all this information, he actually had pretty good sources, despite how the mainstream media might want to mock him. But so one of the things that he points that I think are very important that he points out that I think are very is very important is the fact that the Nord Stream pipeline is a pipeline that is owned half by the Germans and half by Russians, right? So in effect, if the US did blow up that pipeline, it was actually committing an act of war against its own allies, because it was, according to Seymour Hersh, the point of blowing up the pipeline was to guarantee that in case the winter got cold and Europe got cold feet about the war, they would not be able to go back to the pipeline and therefore, you know, slow down the war effort and make it almost like impossible to actually fight that war with Russia. Now, the fact that this is out there, the fact that it, you know, you don't hear like all the different like political voices are just pretty much silencing this, I think is indicative of the times in which we are, right? It's the double speak of Orwell, right? This is the real, like, it's quite impressive actually to watch. I mean, we've come to a point where, you know, like people like Noam Chomsky are treated like clowns, you know, people like Simon Hirsch are treated like clowns. And the truth is, like, then if all these people that have such a long history of denouncing and actually putting out information that most, you know, average citizens couldn't get to if it wasn't for people like them, I find quite surprising that we are able to you know, brush them off like that, with all the kinds of articles that they've been putting out, the kinds of comments about this war, the kinds of consequences for Europe, the kinds of consequences for a third world war, a nuclear war, right? And then you add to that what we've been seeing in market turmoils. You know, I think of, for example, when the sanctions came out against Russia, the idea was to sink the Russian economy. I mean, of course, I don't have a good sense of what the Russian economy is like at this moment, because just like there's propaganda in the West, there's incredible propaganda in Russia as well. So I don't know. But what's clear is that Russia still hasn't collapsed. And yet we're beginning to see banking failures, which have amounted to a huge bailout, if you really start putting together, right? We've had the UBS situation, the Credit Suisse, sorry. We've had the banks in the United States, and this has led to huge bailouts and also changing of the way that banks are protected. So again, going back to the pension reform, it's a pension reform at a time where the people on the street, the worker, is being punished or asked to put on, let's just say not punished, but let's say to put more time, while, you know, the too big to fail crowd are getting more and more bailouts. This will lead to a serious conflict. Now, how that conflict will articulate itself, that's, I think, the biggest question, right? Again, will it be a conflict that, from the people's perspective, it articulates itself in a progressive manner, defending progressive values and defending and democratizing in their process? Or will it be a turn to the far right, where, you know, we become more and more regressive, more nationalist, and everybody just defending their own kind? I don't know the answer to that. I think both are possibilities. I think both are happening in some way. I just don't know which one is going to be the one, if you like, that crystallizes in a huge manifestation or a huge event like the square occupations of 2011, that kind of thing. Something of that kind, I think, is brewing. I just really don't know whether it will be on the right, on the left, or something different, you know, that we haven't even seen yet.
Well, we're going to see it in Europe before we do in North America, and especially in Canada, too. And another result, I mean, yeah, the apparently, the Russian economy hasn't collapsed. The ruble is stronger than it was a year ago. And Russia has accelerated its move towards the east. And I read something recently that put forward that it's not going to come back, that Russia has given up investing its future with Western Europe altogether, which I guess is a win for the Americans after all. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Pablo Uziel. Pablo is a postdoc at the Université du Québec à Montréal. His area of study is the European Union, political, legal, and economic integration from above and below, and settler colonialism and Canadian society. His book is Democracy Here and Now, the Exemplary Case of Spain. About Spain, last time we talked in August of last year, Pablo, you said, and I'll quote you about the situation then, you said, "We're on the Titanic and it's sinking. And the feeling is, let's just go to the beach." And you were saying that in terms of a kind of political nihilism that was rising in Spain. Well, is that what's going on there now? And I'm sure that they're looking over to France with great interest.
Yeah, I think, you know, if in France the frustration sort of crystallizes in a sense with revolt and revulsion, in Spain, the discontent at this particular conjuncture is crystallizing in a kind of apathy, right? There's a sort of general apathy, or and the general exhaustion I think the most exhausted, honestly, are the political parties. I think that the majority of the population, I mean, this is obviously generalizing, but I just, you know, in a kind of trying to point to the sort of imaginary of what, you know, the center of politics looks like right now in Spain, it's just a space that it's like a planet with no life. You know, you're sitting there, you're looking at it, you're trying to see if something moves, but everything is more of the same, right? We're exhausted of the corruption scandals that we've had to endure, and the little repercussions that have come out of those for those who committed the corruption. We're exhausted by the pandemic, and I'm speaking in a we in a very loose sense, but you know, there's an exhaustion from the pandemic. There's a sort of indifference to the Ukraine war, except from, well, of course we have to defend it, but that, you know, that's actually quite a worrisome fact, because you know, we haven't responded like that to the war in Afghanistan, or I mean, the last war where there was a response in Spanish population was the Iraq war, right? After that, there has been no response. There hasn't been, and for this one, there's a response, but it's very closely tied to, I would argue, racism, you know, and the fact that, you know, people in Ukraine are understood as white, like us, therefore, and it's part of the discourse, right? It's not like me making this up. It's not even coming from the street. It's just listening to the European leaders and to the national leaders of Spain. But in terms of what is happening today, if you go to Spain, I think, well, we have municipal elections, regional elections coming up in a couple of months, I think, or a month. I can't remember the date right now. So that is kind of preparation for the general elections.
It's May 28th. May 28th okay, is so the municipal and regional elections.
And then I believe there's a general election towards the end of the year or early next year, right?
Yeah, so December, maybe.
Yeah, so that's basically these regional elections are the sort of build up to the national elections, and you're seeing movements, the ruptures in Podemos and the sort of the left to the left of the Partido Socialista. It's in a decomposing mode. I think that's most of the criticism. That's most of the reading I've come across from people within that space, that it's decomposing, that it's kind of like if there was a moment of a high point of sort of new politics as in institutional politics, it was in 2014-15, and then since then it's just been decaying. The coalition between the socialists and Podemos is weak at this point. They're passing through some of the legislation that they were promising to electorate. So in that sense, you know, you can't really say it has been terrible. But I mean, I don't think it's, from my perspective, I don't think it's carrying this strength to win a next election. I think that the next elections will probably be won by the Partido Popular and with support of Vox. I think that's coming. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it's one more election away. But that space is building up strength.
Well, that marks a strong move to the right. For those that aren't familiar with the parties in Spain, which I would think was probably most people here, Podemos is the coalition government. They're left of center, maybe, I don't know, roughly like the NDP. Would I be wrong in saying that? And they look like they're moving to something maybe even a little further right than Canada's Tories, right?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. And then you have this Sumar, which is a sort of coalition of disenchanted Podemos people and people, you know, from the municipal projects that have been developing over the last few years. And they're trying to come to an agreement with Podemos, but that's turning out to be quite a fight. It's the person that's leading Sumar is a minister in the current coalition government, but she was the one that Pablo Iglesias, when he left Podemos, kind of selected without any prior process of discussion with the voters, right, with the members of the party. So I think that space, in a sense, it's right now, well, it's actually opening up the space for something beyond the the institutional political space to articulate itself, in the sense that I think that the more the left is weakened in the institutional space, the more the history of Spain tells us that when that happens, the margins quickly begin to become more prominent in the political space. So I think that although it looks very depressing, I hear a lot of depression. I was in a conference this morning organized by some academics in New York, and they were talking about the 15M movement, and they were talking about where we are now in Spain, and everybody sounded very depressed, and I certainly relate to that. It's a very toxic political space right now in Spain, but I would argue that it's not just the political space. Because of the deterioration of our social contract, if you like, there's also a lot of this is kind of like a lack of civics right now happening in the society. Like, no one cares very much about the other, and I worry about that, because it shows the signs what you were quoting that I said regarding the Titanic still holds for me today.
Well, given the context of Spain's political history in the 20th century, that's a really frightening prospect. And we've seen that this kind of disengagement and nihilism has led in the past to a move to right-wing nationalism and the divide in the country. I don't know. We don't want to think who the next strongman might arise there, and what that could mean. We're fast running out of time, Pablo. But before we go, we in the past have often talked about Catalan. It's not Catalan politics, Catalonia. I haven't seen a lot of news about what's going on there lately, or about Pablo Hasél, the rapper who is still in prison, as far as I know, for offending the king. Juan Carlos, of course, was driven out of the country, the victim of that offense, but he's planning a return trip any day now, I read, to test the waters, because he's basically been a criminal on the lam from Spanish law. Can you comment on those two things in our final couple minutes?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because the king right now is arrived to Spain, I think, yesterday or this morning.
Oh, he did. Sailing. Oh, okay. There
yeah,
you go.
So that's good. But he's doing it much more quietly than the last time. Of course, that, much more quiet doesn't mean anything, because he's there. It's all being reported on, and the usual suspects are welcoming his return. But I mean, he's made clear that he's going to maintain his residency outside of the country. And the truth is, everybody knows why that is, right? And it's to do with taxes, and it's to do with basically having funneled millions of dollars outside of Spain into accounts that are his in other countries. So he had a little trip to London. He went to a private club with some of his friends, and now he's in Sanxenxo in Galicia to go sailing. And then he's going to go back. And so that's the king. Well, Hasél is still, dealing with the consequences of basically expressing, what the king has been up to. And then in regards to Catalonia, it's a quiet time in regards to Catalonia, unless you're really following the local politics. Then you see, but you do see in Catalonia that like Puigdemont's party, which is, Puigdemont is the exiled ex-Catalan president in Belgium. Well, his party is decomposing. That's clear. And it could mean that we see a change in the local politics of the in different regions of Catalonia, which could be interesting, because it might somehow begin to oxygenate this space and get us away from this, this space in which, everybody's just defending their own no matter what they are doing, right? It's if you're pro-Catalan and there's a case of corruption against a pro-Catalan political leader, then no one is going to go and sit out and defend it, right? And vice versa, if this happened to a, sort of a a Spanish unity party, as they like to call themselves, you know, and there's a case of corruption with one of their leaders, then all those that are against Catalan independence are going to be supportive of them. And I hope that this can break, because, again, there is no real dialogue. There's just a conflict between interests. And this population, from my perspective, humbly, you know, I would say that it's just, you know, observing this political space that has gone completely out of control from the population. We don't have a say, you know, and it's a very tragic reality. And that's what keeps me most of the time in Canada, because it's still a pretty unlivable space if you're really genuine about wanting to be in spaces where you can at least democratize the society. You
know? And Pablo Hasél, his 27 months in prison later, it's already been established that he was, quote, unjustly convicted of crimes, in scare quotes, that violate the right to freedom of expression for insulting the king, ostensibly. The king that is an absconding criminal.
I mean, just to finish, like, my little contribution here, Chris, if we... Look, until we are live in societies where the person that points out the emperor is naked, instead of going to jail, gets a medal, you know, we are going to be in societies that are very easily manipulable and that are being led into destruction, right? And I mean, this sounds like, wow, very catastrophic, but I'm just like looking at the things as they play out, right? Think about someone like Assange. You know, you can like more or less the character, but the truth is, you know, he's enduring a nightmare because of revealing information that we all needed to know about how our governments work, right? The same is going to happen to the guy, to the person that just released the latest data. And yes, of course, we accept it because the law says that this, you know, that these are state secrets and all this. But if we accept that logic, then it means we allow states to do whatever they want with what they call, you know, general interest, right? So I think we need to rethink our societies and be much more critical when, you know, our king, in the case of Spain, comes sailing while we all know he has Spanish taxpayer money, and the person that denounces this is sitting in a jail cell. So it's a tragic moment.
Yeah, and since we last spoken, I think it's gotten all that much more worse. And the difference between Assange and this young kid that got arrested recently too, whereas the so-called free press ignored the plight of Julian Assange, the journalist, publisher, still languishing in prison. In this case, they assisted in the arrest of the whistleblower and purposefully exposed him, not even accidentally, like the has been done in the past by The Intercept on more than one occasion. Pablo, it's always fantastic to speak with you. I do look forward to our next talk, and thanks to John Philpott, and remind everybody of their book, Sanctions, A Wrecking Ball in a Global Economy. Pablo, they're going to be in Montreal in a couple of days presenting that book on the sanctions regimes and the damages they cause. You should catch it while you're there. I wish I was. Thanks, though, Pablo, for coming on, eh?
Yeah, thanks, Chris. And I thank you for being a space of resistance, of counterconducts, and of transformation, because it's spaces like this from which we can continue to speak with each other, and maybe over time we'll see the societies we want to see.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a thin space, but let's hope it broadens. Thanks again, Pablo.
Thanks, Chris.
Et pour vous personnellement, que représente le général Franco?
Pour moi, c'est un exemple vivant, jour à jour, par son dévouement patriotique envers en service de l'Espagne. Et à part ça, j'ai pour lui une très grande affection et admiration.
Cuántos millones y millones han saqueado y derrochado durante tantos años tantos miembros de la familia real. Luego los psicópatas que nos gobiernan dicen que no hay dinero para derechos de primera necesidad, pero tienen los años contados. Se acerca la República Popular. Está la historia de Juan Carlos el Bobón que quieren ocultar. Contar quién es y qué hace es delito. Apuntaba maneras cuando mató a su hermano Alfonsito. ¿Quién se cree que fue un accidente? Ni Maruenda imaginando a Rajoy desnudo cuando miente.
torrente. Es un santo al lado de Juanca. Ya denunciaron que a Sofía maltrata. ¿Qué legitimidad tiene el heredero de Franco? Que en juergas y puta nuestra pasta está tirando. Se ríe de su impunidad en un char en Suiza. Imagínalo borracho diciendo:
el pueblo me dijo.
Con la pija de su amante recuerda cazas de elefantes. Mientras aumenta el hambre y la injusticia que lo cace. A la cárcel van los pobres, no la infanta Cristina. Pero medio país le desea la guillotina. No sabe ni hablar.
¿Por qué no te callas?
A mí no me cierra la boca semejante canalla.